what we talked about last time in any detail, but you will remember we were talking about the process of one person talking to another, or of an individual who is his own listener. And we were trying to become aware of the processes involved in communication and some of the problems, some of the factors which affect it. And we had got to stage four, which is concerned with the symbolization, which is going to represent in the diagram the symbolization process, the symbolizing of not the world out there at stage one, obviously, this would be impossible, but the world as we filter it individually through our nervous systems, through our eyes and ears literally, through the nervous system, brain, and what at four we somehow transform into symbolic form, into words, pictures, tunes in the head or whatnot, are the silent goings on inside the nervous system represented in the diagram at stage three. So we talk about ourselves inevitably, and always to some degree, although we may also to some degree be talking about something other than ourselves. And the great emphasis I tried to talk with last time had to do with the distinction between knowing and not knowing that you are projecting, that you are talking about yourself, that you are symbolizing something going on inside your nervous system, and that the person who is dogmatic, who speaks dogmatically, is not only using a tone that is difficult to react to, but is probably to some degree deluded. He is to some degree not conscious of the abstracting that he is carrying on and that is affecting what he says. Let's say some more about these factors then at stage four. We talked about the influence of vocabulary deficiency, of lacking certain kinds of languages, as it were, such as the language of chemistry, the language of psychology, and so forth. And the most serious kind of lack in this regard, I would think, would be the lack of a language, an adequate language for talking about language, the lack of a meta-language. And this course is designed to provide you with the meta-language, the language for talking about language behaviors. So we're using a meta-language almost all the time in this course. Other factors which affect the output at five, the what you say, the verbal output, what determines what you say, are, for example, certain language structure factor. Our language has a structure. Whatever language you may use at stage four to symbolize whatever you have to symbolize, the language has a structure of some sort. And that means things like this. First of all, our language has a categorical structure. It is made up, in part, of nouns, as we call them. And these nouns, for the most part, are names for categories of things, or for groups, lumps, assemblages of some sort, kinds, types. So that we symbolize them in terms of these categories, as we say. The language which you've learned, what you call English or French or whatever, the common language which you use every day, is something like a cookie cutter which you impose upon whatever you're talking about, and you pick it up and you have lumps, you have biscuits. You talk about kinds of things. You talk about what you have names for. You tend not to talk about what you don't have names for. You are more used to using some of these names than others. It's always possible to make some kind of analysis and arrive at some kind of an explanation of the reason why you use some names more than others. But one of the very basic kinds of research on language behavior is concerned simply with the frequency count of the use of words. In one of the investigations I did, in which we used patients in a mental hospital with schizophrenia, I directed, I should say, we found that almost 10% of the words used by the schizophrenic patients was the pronoun I. The frequencies with which we use certain words are very important. This is a very important fact of our behavior, our language behavior. I developed a measure which you'll find described in the appendix of the book called the type token ratio. TTR, if you want to. Abbreviation for it. It's the ratio of the different words you use to the total words. So that in speaking 100 words, if you use 65 different words, your TTR would be 65. It's, now, you can conceive of a person having a one-track mind who always talks about the same thing, nothing but money, 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 or football all the time, and this would be reflected in a type token ratio that would be rather low. That is, he won't use many different words in saying 1,000 words or 100 words or whatever the base is that you use to compute the measure. Whereas a person with broad interests will have a high TTR for his total language behavior. And so you have here a really highly precise kind of index or measure of what we usually talk about loosely as the breadth of our interests or the degree to which we are rigid in our preoccupations and so forth. If you want to find out precisely about yourself or anyone else in this regard, you can by using such a measure as this. Well, there are other things about this that are more important, about the structure of language that are more important than that. This is a rather important fact, though. The degree of differentiation the language you use. One of the very important things that is related to this is the fact that we tend to concentrate upon two kinds of things usually. We tend to sort what we talk about, what there is to talk about, what there is to observe in the world around us into two piles, the good and the bad, the interesting and the uninteresting. We tend to sort people into those we like and don't like, into the dull and the brilliant, and so forth. We have various kinds of fateful dichotomies, or either-or-ish choices, such as the black and the white, the Jew and the Gentile, and so on. These become terribly important, and they can be very usefully studied as aspects of the language behavior of people. The classical logic, the Aristotelian form of logic, is essentially a set of rules for maintaining this kind of either-or-ish evaluation. X is either A or B. It has to be either A or B. It cannot be both. These are Aristotelian logical laws. And I think most of us find them congenial. We're used to them. We're used to this kind of thinking, this pattern of thinking. You can't be both good and bad, we say. But of course, in the meantime, you are, you know, depending upon the point of view from which you are judged. You can't be both tall and short, you say, but of course you are, depending upon whether you are being judged by someone taller or shorter than you are. There is a relativity to this, which, of course, is highly important. The moment you resort to a highly differentiated kind of language, you immediately point up the problem of the either-or-ish kind of evaluation. So long as you talk in terms of tall and short, you can talk fairly well until someone asks the embarrassing questions of what do you mean. But when you talk in terms of height, in inches we'll say, well now then you point up the problem. Where do you draw the line? How tall is tall? And it really becomes immediately apparent how difficult it is to talk sense this way. Until you have talked sense this other way. Now, the point is that if we will hold a convention and we will discuss this matter, and someone will finally rise and say, I move that anybody taller than 5 feet 10 inches is tall. And someone seconds the motion, and we vote, and it comes out 382 to 246 in favor. Well, all right, if this is the game we want to play, we agree to play by the rules, parliamentary rules, then from that time on, anybody taller than 5 feet 10 inches is tall. Now we can use the words tall and short and know what we're talking about. And that's how you do it. And if you don't do it that way, it's a mess. Now, of course, I say that's how we do it. And if you don't, I mean, there must be some consensus You don't necessarily have to have votes, but there must be a consensus. This is a kind of subject to talk about that is just so full of implications I can hardly make any headway. Let me take time out. It's always interesting things, you know, that you don't have in your notes. Several years ago, there was a philosopher named Black who wrote an article in which he had this idea. He said, let's arrange an array of things that we could call chairs, or not call chairs, but maybe we'd call chairs. We'll start out with a stump, a tree stump. We'll end up with a davenport or a bed. Now then, we will ask people to point to the chairs. And he said, when we do this, of course, what will happen is that we will get some people, we will get some of these objects, like maybe the tree stump, on which practically all agree that is not a chair. So we get a high agreement there. And over here, they will agree that the davenport and the bed are not chairs. But, and here they will, let me put some more in here. Here they will agree, these are chairs. But he said, you always have a vagueness fringe. Here's a vagueness fringe. Here's a vagueness fringe. And here's where you get all the fights and all the fusses, all the conflicts. The tis taint kind of distress. You can do this with anything, not just chairs. We'll say good behavior. And we'll get some examples. Almost everybody will agree. That's good behavior. This is not good behavior. This is not good behavior. This is not good behavior. They're too extreme. This is. And here you get a vagueness phrase. And all sorts of conflicts arise. The fact that our language is a noun-y language, has a categorical structure, that it's essentially lumpy. The basic principle, you see, is that there are more things to talk about. There are more experiences, more observations to make, to talk about, than there are words to talk about them. So each word must do heavy duty. Each word must refer to more than one thing. And so you have the problem then of ambiguity. Ambiguity is one of the very most fascinating problems in the world. It's a distinctively human problem, you see. It has to do with language. I suppose you might first react by thinking that ambiguity is always bad. You shouldn't have these vagueness fringes. Well, consider the problem of writing legislation. If you think about it very long, you will realize that the secret of writing good legislation is to have just the right degree of ambiguity. If you're too precise, the law will not be generally applied and it will be out of date too soon. You can't make it just for this situation. It's got to be for some period of time, and during that period changes will occur, and it must be for some kind of a geographical scope, and not all the situations within that area will be alike. So you got to have just the right degree of ambiguity. Now, if it's too ambiguous, nobody will know how to enforce it or to apply it. And if it's too specific, it won't be applicable in many situations. Ambiguity is fascinating. I must get on. There are other aspects of language structure. For example, the basic English sentence might be said to be, A is B. The subject predicate form. Subject predicate form. A is B. Think of this. This is one of these inexhaustible subjects, but let's say a few things about it. Think of this as two nouns. And think of it also as a definite. A noun, an adjective. Now you supply examples. For instance, let's take two examples. Two kinds of examples. John is a chemist. John is a chemist. Let's try to make this somehow meaningful. Suppose you're a book publisher. How will you organize your company? How will you handle all the manuscripts and all the books you're going to publish? Well, if you do like most publishers do, you will have departments. And you will have one that will be responsible for books on chemistry. And there will be an editor in charge of the books on chemistry. And so it will be very significant when one of his field representatives sends in a report on John Bordley or somebody and he says, John is a chemist. Right? Everything that happens to John after that will depend on that. This is classification. This in institutional life is departmentalism. And your life is going to be tremendously affected by this. This reduces eventually to language structure. To this sentence form. We talk this way. We could say it other ways, you know. We could say, John appears to be a chemist to me, but probably to his wife he's something else. John may appear to the head of a manufacturing company to be some other type of person. Maybe he's a... not just a chemist, maybe he's a fabrics specialist. Or maybe after he's been around a while, they will decide, no, he's an administrator. You are constantly being affected by the classification behavior of the people who are reacting to you. Take the adjective business. You go to work for General Motors or for the University of Illinois or wherever, and you will be evaluated. This may be very formal, as it is in many industrial organizations, or once a year or oftener. A meeting will be held about you. And in the meantime, information will be gathered, and there will be a file on you, and evaluations will be made, and they may use some kind of scales to rate you on. And they are trying to decide, every time they do this, whether you should be promoted or maybe transferred or something. You're being evaluated. But even if it isn't formal, you're being evaluated. At the University of Illinois, this probably wouldn't happen in this highly formal way. It would happen in conversations at the faculty club when you weren't there, and so on. But you're being evaluated. And the adjectives that will be linked with your name are very fateful to you. And it will be said eventually as a kind of a consensus, a final judgment, that you are competent or that you are not competent. and they will use the word are. Very, very seldom will any one of them say appears to be conscious to me. They will impose this cookie cutter upon you. And this can be very usefully investigated. This kind of behavior that we call evaluating other people can be very usefully studied as language behavior of people. What kind of language do they use? I remember in one conference I happened to be in some months ago, one man who worked for one of the large corporations said that he had insisted at the last one where he took a job that they throw away all their evaluation forms, because on these forms there are sentences already written. All you have to do is make check marks, and this tends to restrict the evaluations made and the form in which they're made. So he insisted that everybody involved in evaluating a man come to a meeting. They have meetings with nothing but a pencil and a piece of paper. And if there's anything to write down, or to write it down, otherwise they will adjourn the meeting. But no forms to fill out. What would you do in this kind of a situation? Would you abandon all the forms? See, this man had obviously studied some general semantics. He had. This was one thing that he had concluded from his study of general semantics. Throw away all the forms, evaluation forms. European education. I made some remarks, didn't I, the other day? I came home with an impression that our education is far superior to the European, in spite of anything that the Admiral may be saying these days, because of one thing, that we have a much different relationship between the teachers and the students. I think it would be pretty difficult for me to stand up here and say nonsense and get by with it. I don't believe I'm doing that. You might not care to hold up your hand and challenge me, but I don't think I'd get it past you. I believe you have a pretty good sense of the phony, and especially the pompous phony. I don't think you carry your attitude toward me, attitude of deference, if there is any, to the point that you don't evaluate what I say. But I think that in Europe there is a good deal of this, of just utter deference to the professor. And I think it's very bad for everybody. But there's also something that has to do with what we're talking about. They have examinations at a very early age, around the age of 11. In England, I think they call them the 11s or the 11 pluses or something like that. And on the basis of this examination, this is another evaluation system, you see. The children are divided into those who will be educated and those who won't be. Those who will be prepared, that is, for higher education, go to college, into universities and into the professions, and those who won't. The result is an enormous waste of human talent, human resources. Ordinarily, it really doesn't even matter if the child is sick that day. That's the day for the exam. And for the rest of his life, he's going to be reacting to the evaluation made of him that day. Occasionally you may find someone who's a little understanding of this situation, but it's very hard to do anything about it in the system. Uh, I think this can be usefully investigated in terms of the language behavior of the educational people who do this. The child is either, he either passes or fails, you see. This is a two-valued tyranny. And I think you can talk about it, you can investigate it, you can theorize about it, especially effectively by regarding it as language behavior. And you can talk about it in terms of the language structure very effectively. Another kind of language structure is represented by this kind of sentence. A does something to B. The transitive verb. The verb which represents, which symbolizes, to get back to what we're talking about, stage four of the process of communication, which symbolizes a relationship as a one-way relationship. For example, we say things like John loves Mary, as though that were not a remarkable kind of a statement. As though, unless Mary loves John too, it's a very, very peculiar relationship. And so, what we would have if we were going to say that John and Mary love each other would be something like that. Now, we can say it. It takes more words. It will not be done automatically. You have to be thoughtful to say it that way. The easy way to talk in our language is with transitive verbs, with one-way relationship verbs. I will teach you. This is easy to say. It would take me a little time to figure out how to say it otherwise, and then it would probably sound funny to you. I could say something like, you and I are going to study together for this semester. And I don't think you'd believe it. It's easier to say, I'm going to teach you. And this is a transitive verb. This implies a one-way relationship. First of all, it says, you're not going to teach me anything. But you know you do. At least if I'm a good teacher, you do. If I'm a good teacher, I'm a good learner from you. And if I'm not, I won't very long be a good teacher. If I never learn anything from my students. Besides it, this way of talking encourages you to just sort of come and hold still for it. You're not going to do anything. I'm going to teach you. You just come and sit. And I think to a rather alarming degree, that is what students do in many situations. And I think one of the reasons they do it is because of the language structure. They're used to talking this way. Another effect it tends to have is that you tend to evaluate the situation in terms like this. He is a good teacher, or he isn't. It's easier with this kind of language to do that than it is to wonder about yourself in the situation. You're part of the interaction. Nobody has said anything about an interaction. And so you wouldn't automatically wonder about you're part of the interaction. In fact, it's a little disturbing to wonder about it. What about you're part of this interaction? It's easy, that is, to take a passive kind of a role. When what we're talking about is a one-way relationship. And this is the sort of thing we have in clinics and hospitals. I will help you. Doctor, how soon can you cure me? You see, the implication is I'm not going to do anything at all but just be here. You cure me now. I'll lie down while you do it. I've been asked this many times by people who stutter. Doctor, how soon can you cure me? I got a letter the other day from a dear little girl in New Hampshire who has written me before. And this time she said, in effect, doctor, can you cure me? I don't know how I'm to do this from here to New Hampshire, but she said, I'm going to be married in August, and after I get out of school in June, I'd like to be cured. Now, this is often the situation you deal with. I've had a number of students whose parents have sent them here at the university because we have the speech clinic. And they have come and attended the university. The speech clinic's here, but they haven't been to it. But they come, this has often happened, believe me, come in April or May even of the last year. And they say, gosh, I'm going to get a job in June. Could you get me over the stuttering? Could you cure me? Now, I think this can be understood about as well in terms of the basic language structure that these people, that you and I, have learned to speak. I'm talking about the culture, not about individuals as being somehow irresponsible or not. Not at all. I'm talking about the culture. And the basic thing that distinguishes a culture is the language of the people. And our language tends to be a transitive verb language. This means it tends to be a language of irresponsibility, or of taking too much responsibility. I will teach you. Now that's taking too much responsibility. I'll work with you if you want to learn. That's a more responsible way to word it. I can do that. I'm not at all sure I can teach you. This is making a claim that possibly will turn out to be fraudulent. Just to promise to teach you would probably be dishonest in most situations. But I can promise to work with you, but our language makes it very difficult for me to say that in a way that you would immediately grasp. And I think you would tend to react to any way that I'd be able to word it. You'd tend to react a little diffidently. You're not used to it, and you think I'm pulling something. And if you make love without using the transitive verb form, I don't know how successful you'd be. You're supposed to say, I love you. You're not supposed to say, you know, I think you and I might be able to love each other if we'd work at it. Now, this would make much, much more sense and be much more honest, but I'm not too sure that in our culture you would get away with this too. I think this kind of language, this transitive verb language, in the relationships as between doctor and patient, teacher and pupil, parent and child, all such relationships in which the kinds of things that are said are things like, I will help you, I will cure you, I will teach you, I will treat you, or from the other direction, won't you please teach me, won't you please help me, won't you please cure me. I think this kind of language tends to be very bad for both parties. I think it makes teachers and parents and doctors very much out of touch with the realities of what they do. I don't think they notice the interactions in which they're operating as much as they would if they talked about the interactions. I think that it is very bad for a teacher to think, to tell himself day after day that he is doing the teaching around here. And none of the learning. I think it's very bad for the student to tell himself that he is doing none of the teaching here. He's only a kind of sponge that's soaking up something that happens to be dripping. I don't think this is good for people. I think there's much more of a sense of responsibility engendered on both parties by the language of interaction. Now you have to work at it. You talk a language of interaction with the English language or with the French or Japanese or any other, as far as I know. Now related to this is another thing, animistic language forms. That is, our language seems to have been invented, and it was, of course, invented by ancient, ignorant men. It seems to have been invented by someone who thought that that nothing could happen without somebody or something making it happen. And so our language is full of words, mostly nouns and pronouns, which seem to refer to agents who do things. And so we say things like, for example, it is raining. What's raining? Now this is so innocent, you think, oh, this can't be important. Well, but wait a minute. What are you talking about? If you are aware of what you're talking about, you probably are talking about the god of the rain. This is probably what the ancient person who made up the language, who invented the language, was talking about. It's raining again. Eh? Is that what you're talking about? Don't you know what you're talking about? We say things like, the wind is blowing. What else? I mean, it takes the wind to blow? There is an agent here, is there? The lightning flashed. Whorf says that the Hopi Indians have one word for that. They don't have an agent. They don't have their language is not full of these spooks. That's the Hopi word, which corresponds to the lightning flash. Only it just means flash. There's no agent doing the flashing. There's no lightning doing the lightning. Well, these things are. These examples are interesting because they're a little bit startling, perhaps. But let's look at some others. The market may go up. I think that you ought to read pages of the news. Paper that you may not have been reading because you tell yourself, I'm not interested in that. Well, you can be interested in it now because you're interested in symbols. What kind of symbols do you find on the market page? What sorts of sentences are there? There's some very interesting ones, like the market is testing the April lows this week. Observers are standing by to see whether the market will rise above the 600 Dow Jones level. The market is a great beast that is tramping up and down Wall Street. You read the market page long enough and you get the idea there's nobody there but this beast. There's just the market there, that's all. No people there at all. No people doing anything. It's just the market, sort of. People say my neurosis is worse this week. My neurosis is worse. Of course, I get this all the time from people I work with. They say, my stuttering comes and goes. Isn't that a remarkable sentence? My stuttering comes and goes. This is animistic language. They're not just animistic words. Any word can be used animistically. I can talk about my ulcer as though he lived here like Roger the Lodger. And I had nothing to do with Bill Ulcer. My ulcer is acting up today, I say. The stutterer says the word will not come out. This is animistic language. The word will not come out. And you try to visualize, what is it like? The word, he feels that he's refusing to come out. Now, what is this word that won't come out? This is very important in affecting the behavior of this daughter in determining what he will do about talking. If he really has convinced himself, as he has almost always, that the words will not come out unless he forces them out, then he does exactly what you see him doing. He's going to force those words out, and so he works at it. And what happens when you work at anything using your jaws and tongue and lips? Well, when you work, you exert effort. And when you exert effort, you have to exert it against something, with something. And so you have one lip here and one here. You exert effort. Nothing happens, of course. And you say, the word won't come out. And really, I think it's very difficult to do much for such a person, for him to do much for himself, rather, until he learns another language. And I think this holds not just for persons who tell themselves their words won't come out. I think this holds for people who tell themselves that they have shyness or something. Oh, it's much after time to go, isn't it? I forgot to set my alarm. Well, have a good time on the exam. We'll see. We'll continue. There's an attendance sheet or something going around, isn't there? What do you want done with it? No, I'm leaving this week. What do you want to talk about?
Well, about this book.
Writing about Louis Martin. Well, yes, since you can't talk to me, why don't you talk to Joel and Louise? What especially, what would you have said? How would you have started?
I feel that I can grab the information, I can read it and say, oh yes. But then it all seems away. It's kind of like I hear that I can't quite put my finger on
it. Well, you want to read it, it comes over about you. What you're saying about you and what you did the last hour.
Well, I do.
Well, then.
But then again, it's like you said to me, define general humanity somewhere. I don't think I can do it.
Well, I won't ask you to.
I mean, or process of abstracting in levels, the way you explain it, I can grasp this. I mean, it seems all very elementary, and then it's not. It is, but it isn't. Well, I'll continue to read, and I'll go ahead and talk to Joe.
Do you talk to others about it? Do you share your perplexity? Do you have bull sessions about it?
Yeah.
Well, I think you have to. You have to talk about this. You talk about football, you talk about goals, you talk about it. Talk about this.
Well, we do talk about it, but we haven't said, you know, on Tuesday at 3 o'clock we're going to talk
about it. No, I don't mean that.
Oh, I see. Well, we talk about it all the time.